Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live. We have a powerful, powerful show today about a cult called Buddha Field. We've had some folks that have escaped cults on the show before. Some of the recent cults we had were probably more Christian-based in their influences. This one seems to be more Eastern-based. A guy that taught yoga and was in West Hollywood as a charismatic guru type named Michelle, I believe was the name he went by. We have two courageous guys that will be joining us here in a minute. Filmmaker Will Allen made a film that just blew the lid off this thing and really confronted and exposed what was going on in terms of the leader being a sexual predator on many of the men in the group. Will Allen and his compatriot Chris Johnston, two guys that really have had a lot of courage in standing up to this, and we'll be back with them in about 30 seconds. And the film that they made, which went to Sundance and was featured on CNN and is a powerful, powerful piece of work for many reasons that we'll get into in this interview, is called Holy Hell, Holy Hell. And I really recommend you see it. I mean, you'll get a lot from what we talk about, but the visual images and things of the film is just so well done. So I want you guys to sit back and think about religion and think about cults and what makes a toxic group versus a healthy group. We've had several other people from cults on in this one. This one just hit me between the eyes. It was just so well done. So we'll be back in about 20 seconds with filmmaker Will Allen and Chris Johnston, who also lectures on what he's learned from this experience up in Northern California. We'll be right back with these two courageous guys. Thank you for tuning in to Richard Rossi Live.
I know what you're thinking. Since the phone lines are all busy, should I or shouldn't I keep calling? Well, if I were you, I'd keep trying. Go ahead and make your day.
Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live. We do have a lot of people interested in the subject, but if you want to send in a question right now, we're going to talk with our guests, I think, before we get into any questions you'd have about this. You could send it to richardrossilive@gmail.com. There is a number on the screen. But I don't think we'll deal with that right now because I really want to talk to these two guys first about how they lock their religion in the best sense of the word, as REM thinks about. So let's go live now. We're going to be joined in a few seconds here live. Well, welcome, Will, and welcome, Chris. I'm so grateful you guys came on the show today.
Yeah,
thanks
Hi,
for having us.
Thank you, yes. This is Will.
Will,
and
you're a very talented filmmaker, and Chris, you both were so articulate in this experience. I guess we'll start with you, Will. Your childhood background, you were a creative kid and making films that kind of related to you at the outset because we were similar types of kids with our little movie cameras running around and trying to duplicate some of those great TV shows that we saw, like Wonder Woman and things like that. And so you were kind of creative from the outset. Your DNA was very artistic. You know, you had an interest in those things, huh?
Yeah, I was always trying to capture, you know, either making films or capturing life around me and trying to understand the world through the camera.
And where did you grow up, Will?
I grew up in California. I was really lucky. I had a great family. We kind of had money. We lived in Newport Beach, so I was exposed to wealth and everything. And I think by the time I got out of film school, I was looking for something deeper than money, right? Mm. And I went on a little bit of a spiritual journey.
Mm. You know, that's one thing that struck me with your powerful film, Holy Hell. And by the way, what's the best way you'd recommend for listeners to see it?
Well, you know, it's on iTunes. It's on Amazon. You can rent it, you know, for very inexpensive. It's on Netflix also, if you have Netflix.
Okay.
It's available there.
Okay, iTunes, Amazon, Netflix. Yeah, one thing you mentioned, your nice family and everything, that's one thing that did strike me was that you and many of the others in the group did not fit the kind of stereotypical cult victim of, you know, the abusive family and, you know, all this horrid stuff as a kid. You seem to have a kind of a fun childhood, and for the most part, your parents let you do a lot of your fun, unique things that you wanted to do with your creativity and stuff like that. Was there any kind of hurt growing up, though, any kind of rift or any kind of thing that you think made you more vulnerable?
You know, for me, I don't think there was. I was an altar boy. I was raised Catholic. I was very much brought up in Catholic school. And I think if anything, I sort of lost my faith after a while, just because I was having conflict between what was written and what was said, and just the whole educational system didn't quite jive for me. And so I sort of just, you know, if anything, I was always influenced by Catholicism and Christianity, but never quite resonated with it. So I think when I started hearing teachings that were very close to the teachings of that I was raised with, they resonated with me, but they just didn't, you know, they weren't from the Bible exactly. They were more Eastern, mixed with the Bible, mixed with everything for me. So I think I was healing a long search I had when I was younger for all of that realization and enlightenment.
Mm. Now, how about you, Chris? Did you also grow up in California?
I did. I grew up in Southern California in a kind of semi-rural area, and you know, was starting with the topic of religion. I grew up in a Presbyterian family, and nothing really out of the ordinary, but it was just that particular faith tradition just never sat right with me. You know, I wasn't feeling the magic that all of the people around me were clearly feeling. And so when I encountered the Buddha field, these were people that seemed joyous and really, you know, a tight community that cared about each other and were really living what they were talking about. And Will alluded to that a little bit about his experience with religion before the Buddha field. And that's what really attracted me to it, was that these were people that were very, very both joyful, but serious about their faith and about living it. So when I encountered that, it carried all that meaning that I was looking for in other religious traditions and had not found until that time.
And the guru, his name, he went by Michelle. Is that how it was pronounced?
Yeah, met him as Michelle.
Mm-hmm. And for those of us from the outside, you know, the kind of the excessive plastic surgery, the whole persona that we see of him in the film is, it comes off pretty creepy. And so I wondered, you just answered that, Chris, but I wondered what was the draw. And it seems like it wasn't just him, it was the community and the love and the joy of the group and the communal experience and the collective group fellowship with all these people.
It was.
Yeah,
I mean, when I met him earlier. Oh, go ahead.
Please finish your thoughts. Well, I was going to say it. That's really the key thing. There is, it's a phenomenon called social proof. And so,
did you say
I met
social,
all of these people.
Social group.
Social proof. As
social
in, like,
proof.
Evidence. Proof.
Yeah. Social
yeah.
proof. Okay.
Yeah, social proof, and it's a persuasive phenomenon. There's an academic out of ASU, Cialdini, Robert Cialdini, that talks about it. And basically, it's that we like the things that people we like. So
yeah.
You run into this very charismatic group, and even though my initial reaction to the leader was that he was a little creepy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I loved all these people, and, you know, 80 people that I like. Well, he must be okay if they like him, right?
Mm-hmm. So would that be similar to the old term peer pressure?
No, it's much more like the lemming phenomenon. It's the lemming phenomenon. You know, where
like
you have
the animals that all go off the cliff together.
Exactly. And so it's just, it's simply liking what you see, identifying with those people, and then you just sort of go along with it because you want to be part of the social group.
Yeah, for me, Richard, what Chris is talking about and what you asked about the plastic surgery, when I first met him, he was younger, and he didn't look as freaky as he became over the years. He was actually quite beautiful, healthy.
Yeah.
He was an example of an older person who was living happily and spiritually and healthily, and I was inspired by that. Now, the social proof or the groupthink that Chris is talking about, how it affected me, was my sister brought me. So I didn't need to vet him. My sister vetted him. I thought everyone that was in that room had already confirmed that he was who he said he was. And that's what Chris is talking about, social proof. It's like, okay, well, he's already vetted. I don't need to doubt. I don't need to do all that work. Nowadays, you have the internet, and you really need to vet anything you're getting involved in and look into it. But
great advice to our listeners.
Yeah, you have everything at your fingertip. There's no excuse now. You can't look into it. In the 80s, we really didn't have that. In the 90s, we was just developing, and we weren't on the map. But social proof for me was like, I saw all these people looking at him, and they were connecting to something I wasn't in yet, and I just thought, well, I want what they have, you know? Mm.
And you were both pretty young. Weren't you both in your maybe your 20s, early 20s?
Yeah, yeah. How old were you, Chris?
I was 19 when I joined.
Mm. Yeah, I was 22.
Yeah, so you don't have a lot of adult experience either. And I read a study that 86% of the people that get involved in any kind of religious group, it is through trusting what they call the friends, F-R-A-N-S, a friend, a relative, an associate, or a neighbor who says this is a good group.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that truly fits here. Now, the influences of Michelle... I remember in the film, I think he taught yoga. He was involved with ballet. He was kind of a failed actor. I think he was in. You show a clip of him in Rosemary's Baby. Talk about of all the films to have a. I think he was like an extra in Rosemary's Baby, right?
Yeah. He always claimed that some of his scene was bigger, but ended up on the editing room floor, which I imagine he had one more scene or something. But no, he was an actor. He had done acting classes for years. He was a dancer. He'd done dancing classes for years. So he became a bit of an expert in all those areas, and we didn't have that experience. And so he would share a lot of acting techniques and dancing and all these levels of life that we weren't quite exposed to yet. Right, Chris?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was quite dynamic.
Yeah, definitely. And I wanted to correct one thing, because this is actually how he's promoting himself as the yoga master, but he has never taught yoga or had a formal yoga practice in his life.
Mm.
All the yoga that he knows, he's learned from, you know, his followers who were already yoga teachers. So this is something that he's picked up out of convenience to push a narrative of spiritual leadership.
Because that's where he finds his people. That's his demographic, are those yoga type.
Yeah, that's his target market.
Now, so yoga, you think of maybe more Eastern religion influence, you know, some of us have benefited from it for our health, and my bad back and things like that feels better because I do yoga as well. But that makes me wonder, like, his influences. Was he kind of eclectic, and then he's cobbling together a little bit of yoga with a little bit of acting technique? With I think if I recall right, the film mentions he studied hypnotherapy or something like that as well.
Right.
So, did he have certain teachers or speakers that he kind of ripped off their stuff, or was he creating his own message, his own theme? What were the themes or the type of buzzwords or theology, if you will, and was it kind of him like a delicatessen, just a little bit of this and a little bit of that? Or?
Yeah, he did follow one teacher that he would not allow us to read or watch, and he was a guru from India who was really popular in the 80s called Bhagwan Rajneesh, or also changed his name to Osho, and when he got persecuted. He would read all of his books every day, all the time, and he would not let us read them. And he would repurpose that information, and he would make it his own. You're right. And he would hodgepodge things and change words and make it, you know, I don't even know. I mean, he would probably keep things from us and tell us what he wants us to know. And we all thought it was coming out of the mouth.
Yeah,
I wonder if
go
ahead, Chris. I think that was Chris.
I was gonna say, and being an actor, some of Rajneesh's stuff he actually lifted word for word.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. That was actually my next question. Is I wonder if he kept you from it because he was parodying his stuff and he wanted to seem more original and more inspired by you not knowing.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was exactly it. He just lifted Rajneesh's stuff and presented it as his own.
And he told us not to read books, you know, don't read books. Because what happens in these kind of situations, you're discouraged from seeking outside points of view unless it's approved by him. There were certain books he would approve that were very strong in the relationship between the teacher and the disciple, where the disciple would do anything the teacher tells it to do. We were allowed to read those books, right? But the ones that had anything else, we weren't supposed to read. We weren't supposed to watch television. We weren't supposed to listen to the radio. We weren't supposed to be influenced by anything on the outside anymore because we were leaving it all behind, and now we were following him, his guidance.
Mm. So this is textbook cult stuff of don't read. And Rajneesh also was known for, the sex guru, they called him, because he was all about, hey, whatever feels good, do it. And, carte blanche, no ethics or boundaries with sex. And I wonder if he utilized that because of his being a sexual predator that, to justify what he was doing.
Excellent, excellent, excellent statement. I will just say that, in my opinion, he worshipped this other teacher and admired all of his practices, but kept them from us because he wanted to, he was a sexual predator, but he was teaching us not to be sexual, right?
So, yeah, that's the irony, yeah.
It is the irony. And Osho was letting everyone be sexual. He was letting everyone explore themselves, and we weren't supposed to, really. We were supposed to just – so he was keeping things from us yet that he believed in, that he was doing himself, right?
Mm-hmm. Wow. This is a powerful, powerful story. So here you are, and you have this filmmaking talent, Will. So one of the great things about your film, was you had the balance of the interviews now with those that have left and everything, plus the actual footage from the group, because you were somewhat of a documentarian. I guess they found out you were at film school, you had this talent, and so you became involved in promoting them with video stuff and filming stuff. So you had all these wonderful archives of footage. Amazing how you put this whole thing together. Were you ever afraid they'd try to stop you from getting out with the footage, or was that not too big a deal? You had all the footage on a hard drive or something, or how did you get away with that? When I left,
and I left with half of my footage. I mean, I still don't even have all my footage. I think he does. And I didn't ever think I was going to look at this footage again. Why would I look at it? I was never planning on making a movie about it until, therapeutic-wise, I needed to share the story for other people. I needed to tell others what happened. It was too important, after Chris and I discussed it, that we should tell our story. But, I just kind of fell into filming, and I loved doing it. I loved what was happening with my friends, and I loved the guru at the beginning. And I was I'd never seen anything like it, so I tried to capture images I had never seen before, ever, But, they still have some footage, and I left with some of mine, and that's just how it worked.
When did you start to think for yourself or to question, when did the thought hit you both that, am I being brainwashed? Am I in a cult? Was it once he started preying on you sexually, or was it prior to that, or what made the light bulb go off?
Chris, you can.
Yeah, it was a series of things over years. The sexual relationship was what ruined the group for me. Up until that point, I had been in the group 2 years. I didn't realize that he was grooming me just like any sexual predator would, by making sure you can keep secrets, giving rewards, things like that, bringing you into a position of power in the group and then threatening to take it away if you did not go along with what he wanted. But up until that point, I was having a really great experience with the group in general and the meditation practice. And that's when it started to sour. But it wasn't until years after the sexual aspect of the relationship ended that I was able to even coalesce enough of a sense of self to imagine leaving my religion and starting a new life.
Mm. How long were you in the group, Chris? I know Will, I think I read Will was in it about 22 years. Was it about the same for you?
Yeah, I was in it, 1990 until 2007. So, yeah, 17 years.
It must have felt like, the old Rip Van Winkle story in a way, like you were out of society for so long and then having to try to be functional in society.
Yep.
I mean, that must have been scary. Was it scary and challenging to even just reintegrate in society?
Initially, it was a huge relief. Like, finally, I had my life back. But mentally, I think I jumped right back into my shoes as a 22-year-old. Like, psychologically, in my relationships, my developmental stage with relationships and the world was that of a 22-year-old because I had removed myself and extricated myself from all that natural growing process that you would have if you're in the world when you're in your 20s and your 30s. You would explore and find all these answers yourself. I had to start over. I had to start fresh and have the same sort of mistakes and the same frustrations as I would have if I had just gotten out of college, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you never had that normal process, either of you, of, just being out on your own and, mm-hmm. Learning to explore. Now, for you also, Will, was the light bulb going off when he started preying on
you
in a sexual way?
Yeah,
or was
it's so complicated because I was around for 3 years. And I was very, very devoted, and I would do anything for the group, to help and make things happen. We would even have, we would sometimes see these little pieces of paper that said, these are the signs of a cult, charismatic leader, blah, blah, blah. And we would laugh and say, well, that's not us. We're just too smart. We know we're not doing that. Just like a lot of people now who are really involved in certain things, they negate that they're part of that, that's happening to them. But yeah, it took me a long time. I mean, we never used the word cult, because that's like a bad word. But my love for meditation, my love for him, and my love for God got damaged pretty early. And it started when he became sexual with me. That was the thing that never jived in my spiritual experience. And it was abusive, and it never registered as abuse, right? It registered as like, well, you have a problem if this is a problem for you, you have a problem, right? And we're here to work out our problems and to think differently and to be different people than we think we are. So it's all part of the program is to break your ego and to make you, I guess be somebody who you never were going to be, right? Chris, you have a great comment on this topic.
The whole socialization process around it was based around theology, right? I mean, any sort of group you enter into has a set of values and beliefs they operate under, whether it's religious or not. And so our particular theology put him as Jesus, Jesus, Buddha, Krishna, these were all the sort of pantheon of masters that we thought he was sort of on the same level as. And, of course, he was promoting himself as that. So it's hard to say no to Jesus,
Mm-hmm.
That's really what it comes down to. Is for your Christian listeners, I would say imagine that a person that you believe to be Jesus is standing there in front of you and tells you to do something. Are you going to say no?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's something, Chris and Will, that is very important for people to understand, because I'm sure you've probably run into the viewpoint of, you guys were adults, you were choosing to be with him, you were choosing to be sexual with him. But I think that type of flippant assessment does not take into account the unequal power dynamic. And I think you might have even mentioned that in the film, Chris, that this is like a parent Molesting a child. This is like a priest molesting a parishioner. This is like a doctor molesting a patient. This is like Weinstein's recent allegations where he has the power to give this actress the part and give her the Oscar, a teacher and a student. I know I'm going on and on with the metaphors, but
you're right.
But or as you say, it's God asking you to do this.
Absolutely, with that level of authority, because, you know, if you're a believer and a person of faith, I mean, faith by definition disregards that which disproves it.
And also, we were very
powerful position.
and also, with faith, if we're talking about that, you know, it's your most innocent nature. It's your most trusting position. Mm-hmm. It's where you are the most vulnerable when you're trusting in that place. And we trusted him. We didn't think he would do anything that would hurt us, you know, at that point early on. And
yeah, why would Father Michael hurt Johnny? He's a man of God, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now you identify Chris as straight and you as gay, Will. Is that correct? Is that my memory correct from the film?
Yeah.
I've got
some nuance, but in a nutshell, yeah.
Did either of you? Was this challenging for either of you once you left in terms of your view towards sex and relationships or your own sexual identity? Or, you know, in some of the cults we've talked to, we've had, you know, women, say, abused by a guru in the cult, and they get married and they freak out, even with their own husband because this trauma comes back. Was it challenging for either of you just forming relationships after all this?
I would say I'll speak first. Being a gay man who had experiences with men before I got there, it was undeveloped. His whole teaching of relationship was completely distorted. There was nothing. You weren't engaged in your personality or your ego or your anything else that's natural and normal. So when I got out, there's a lot of trust issues, there's a lot of boundary issues. I realized I never had boundaries, and I had to create boundaries. And for me to learn boundaries was a new thing. And I realized I didn't trust people. I realized it was very difficult to let people in and to give myself, you know, emotionally to them and to trust people, you know, because of what had happened for me.
How do you set boundaries now? What would be an example for you, Will, of how you set a boundary?
You say no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, there is a disproportionate play of power in most relationships. I mean, this can apply to people who are in abusive relationships where there's someone just more powerful than you are. And you have the right to just express yourself and say this doesn't feel good. I mean, people who've been abused and who've been in marriages, even in a marriage, the husband or the wife, if they're going to, like, jump on that person, they really should, before they enter into their space, say, hey, is this okay? And how do you feel? And does this feel right? And a conversation should be there. So I actually, my first relationship out of the group, he was a trauma specialist. He was worked with boundaries. And so he taught me boundaries. And he would say, I learned to use them against him, which was funny because I would say no. But, you know, it was a healthy integration into learning that my body is mine, my thoughts are mine. I don't have to do what's expected of me, so to speak. You know, I have my own boundaries, and that's okay. You know, it's not wrong. So.
How about you, Chris? Was it challenging to date after all this, or how are you doing with that whole thing of, relationships now?
I live with my girlfriend partner of almost 3 years now. So,
oh, that's great.
Things are going well in my life. But there was a really rough adjustment in re-socializing with how to meet people and
mm-hmm.
how that went down. I really literally had to learn all of that because it's not like people in the Buddha field weren't pursuing each other. I mean, you know, everybody's human. It becomes attracted to, you know, different people over a period of time. But because of the unique social setting, it took on a really different form when you would pursue a romantic relationship. And of course, the leader purposely put the kibosh on every single one of them that I tried to start up until finally Sophia came around. But
did you meet your girlfriend? Was your girlfriend a part of the group? Was your girlfriend a part of the group, Chris, or did you meet her outside of it after?
No, I met her outside of it after the group. She is not, was never a part of a group or even any sort of similar group.
But I think you liked a girl in the group, didn't you? Didn't you like a girl in the group and they tried to break you up?
Yeah.
Oh, Sophia, yeah, many, many, many times. But the one that made it into the movie was really significant because it allowed me to sort of start to form, again, a sense of self that was independent of the leader. And that was really what was so healing about that relationship.
And one thing, Chris, Richard, that Chris told me, which is really profound, is that when he met finally Sophia, right, and Sophia, see, because the teacher knew everything. Everybody confided everything in him, so he knew what everyone was doing and thinking, and he would manipulate everybody behind the closed doors. And so Chris forged this relationship with Sophia where they trusted each other and would tell things to each other and not tell the teacher, and the teacher was furious. And Chris would say, you need to trust, and Chris would say, trust is earned. It's not just something you give away freely, and we gave our trust away freely. And Chris was finally like, no, you have to earn my trust. And Sophia earned his trust, and he earned Sophia's trust and confidence. And that's when he had his first sense of, I have some privacy. I have someone I can trust. Right, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right on. I love that.
That's another control mechanism, the whole confession thing. Even with the auditing and Scientology, many other religious groups have a way of getting the private information and getting you to open up, but then that can be used against you, unfortunately. So I guess it comes back to the boundaries again, that you don't have to share everything with everyone, especially a person that's not safe.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you guys stay with us a little longer? Some folks are sending in some questions. Can we come back in a few seconds back to you?
Yes.
With some questions.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Okay, well, this is fantastic. And if you want to send in a question, send it in to Richard Rossi Live, or you can call the number on your screen there. I think it's 347-637-2379. We'll be right back with these two courageous guys talking about escaping the Buddha Land cult and the movie Holy Hell.
Live. Get the massage.
Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live, and we're back with a powerful film and filmmaker. The film is entitled Holy Hell. It came out last year, and it's available on iTunes, Amazon, and Netflix. Okay, here's some questions from Mary Lake in New Smyrna. Were there any spiritual practices like mantras, affirmations, teachings, things that, looking back, were used to shift your mindset to make you more vulnerable to the control or the type of relationship he wanted with you, practices of a group mentality to allow your mindset to be more controlled? And I guess both of you, or either of you, if you want to address that, were there some sort of mantras or techniques or things that, like some of the Christian cults, they would be in these long sermons for hours and singing these certain praise music over and over, certain repetitious phrases, and it put them in almost like a trance-like state to be manipulated.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that sort of a thing?
Yeah, Chris can jump in too, but absolutely. We had, I mean, first of all, it was high demand group. And so everything we were doing, we would have five hour meetings with a high level of singing. And he would, you know, we'd all be very vulnerable after meditating and singing for so long. We'd have classes where everything's just reiterated that, you know, your relationship with me, your relationship is through me and your connection with me. And, you know, he was always, like, the songs were about him. So we were singing these songs in our car. We were singing these songs throughout the day. It just became part of our livelihood. So I think everything contributed to what you're talking about. Mantras are repetition of thought and patterns, and we just repeated it all the time. We'd meditate in the morning, meditate at night. And the last thing I'll say is, and this is not against meditation, but we meditated so much, we were always in this very receptive, allowing state. And meditation is not about losing your critical thinking, but the way we practiced it, mixed with his teachings, it was about losing our critical thinking. It was about not thinking, not being in your mind. And that isn't really what it's about. But go ahead, Chris.
Well, I was going to talk a little bit about the mechanic of it, which, you know, went along with what you were saying, too. And it's kind of like you get this good feeling. So basically through ceremony, he shows you this meditation technique. You know, it's a very, very sacred feeling position to be in when you're going in, you're asking for this meditation to be revealed to you. And so when he shows it to you, you have learned this meditation technique from him. But because it's done in a ceremonial way and because it's hyped up as not a technique, it's the experience of God, even though you're doing technical things to achieve that inner feeling, you know, so the techniques basically that enhanced our good feelings of euphoria from the meditation, mm-hmm. he was able to attribute that to himself, versus it being something that was simply going on because we were engaged in a meditation process.
Mm. So these altered states from the meditation made you feel elevated and feel good, and that was kind of a bait in a way to gain his credibility.
Exactly. And to also make us dependent upon him, because the party line was that if you didn't serve the master's work, then God was no longer available to you.
The love will disappear.
Yeah,
you'll be cut off. I mean, if you leave, this will disappear here if you move away from me. And so that's why he's keeping people around him still. They are addicted. They believe through hypnosis. He was a hypnotherapist, and he practiced it every day, every minute. He is a hypnotherapist. Let's not forget that. And he's written books and books on hypnotherapy, okay? So these people around him are believing that this experience is because of him. They see him, Pavlovian response is, I'm quiet, I'm still, I'm in love. I can't do this without him. Without him, I'm thinking and I'm running around. But with him, you know, there's the Pavlov experience. And, you know, it's addictive. It's an I think after working on the film for so long and talking to all my friends, there's an addictive trait. You know, addiction is something good. We were addicted to love. We were addicted to freedom. We were addicted to the thing. And, you know, that's a powerful drug.
Mm. Yeah, and there's language in meditation. I practice meditation myself, but there's language in a lot of the meditation literature about thoughtless awareness and give up the ego and give up the mind. And I can see how that kind of verbiage in his hands created more of a dependency that, you know, the negating of, you know, basically leaving your mind at the door and committing intellectual suicide. And and then the hypnotherapy deals with trance-like states. So this made you guys a lot more vulnerable, huh?
Well, yeah. How else are you going to meet God, which is beyond the mind, if you're in your mind? You have to let go of your mind, drop your mind. And that was our daily practice, was how do I get out of my mind and into God? You know, and so, yeah, it's a lifetime journey because it's a daily practice. You have to do it daily. And we were all committed. We took vows to stay on this path. That's the other thing that's dangerous about cults. You have to have a door. You have to be able to get out. Never commit your life to something that you can't get out of. You know, I had made vows that were between me and my soul, and I was not going to betray that, regardless of him. You know, it was my integrity that kept me there, because I didn't like him, but I was not going to quit what I believed, right?
Mm.
Yeah, and that speaks to another persuasion phenomena, consistency and commitment, is once we publicly declare something, and especially if it's something that we do, you know, a value we hold inside ourselves to be really core and true, we'll stick with that value despite many, many other things to the contrary.
Mm-hmm. Another question following all this up, Forne Vickers in Remington, Indiana. Are you able to meditate now? And if so, how long did it take to regain your own practice apart from the group?
Thank you for that question. That's a very valuable question. I could not meditate afterwards. I did not want to, because when I would visit that sacred space inside myself, he was all over. I would tell people, it's like his fingerprints are all over this place. I can't be here. I can't be here. And someone told me that's just the biggest crime in the world, because we all need to go to our own sacred place to heal ourselves from whatever is going on in our lives. And when you can't go to that sacred place to heal yourself, that's terrible. You know, so yeah, it's taken me a long time, and now my mantra now, if I have one, is I meditate when I want to, I meditate when I need to, I meditate if I feel like it. You know, I don't force myself to do things anymore.
I like that. That's great, and it also relieves some of that bondage. You know, it's a spiritual rape. I mean, it's like, you know, I mentioned some of the people from cults that were sexually abused that, you know, couldn't have sex with their spouse for a while because that memory, you know, was all over. And so it's difficult to say, okay, I'm going to separate glean the good here and, you know, take the abuser off it. Now, this film, holy hell, it really raised hell. I mean, you really expose this guy. What was the kickback? I mean, did he come after you? Did he get lawyers? Did he make him flee? Did people still loyal to him, you know, blow up in your face? I mean, this took a hell of a lot of courage. My God. I mean, what happened when you put this film out?
Well, it showed up at Sundance. We were in a short list of Sundance competition in 2016. And apparently he had seen the film 2 days after it was aired in Sundance. Somehow he had people there. He had copied or filmed it with their phone, and so they knew what they were up against. He's like a politician. He's very cunning. And, of course, they did their own subterfuge. But while I was making it, I kept it very top secret, so nobody knew.
That was
even
smart.
To the point that when we got accepted into Sundance, my producer said, we're not going to put your name on it because you're not finished. Everyone's going to come after you. And so it became a big deal, like, who's this director that nobody knows that's made a film about Sundance, you know, about a cult? So we did our best to keep it quiet. We finally ended up premiering it. I mean, it was a big deal for them. It really, the group broke up. I would say half of them left immediately. But then there's those diehards who just said it was all a lie. Just like, you know, a lot of what's happening in our country, you know, you just believe what you want to believe, and everyone else is a liar.
Yeah.
And so we were the liars. You know, we were the liars. I knew there was power in numbers, which is why I made the movie. Because one person's voice against his isn't going to convince anybody. But I also didn't make the movie for those 100 people who are still with him, because they're the last people who are going to watch it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's for other
people. Yeah, they talk about confirmation bias, that once you're in a groupthink situation, you look for that which confirms your belief, and you just totally dismiss outright anything that challenges it. And I think we have that, like you say, in our country right now with the polarization of the political extremes and everything, where, you know, I have Facebook friends that are right-wing and left-wing, and they all find their sites, and they grab onto those, and they war with each other. And so there was probably the people still with them, just, oh, this is a pack of lies and evil and, you know, that sort of thing, right?
It's true. And he also used to, like, in Hawaii, because he's still in Hawaii and he still has followers, he didn't come after me. And we were on NPR, we were on Rolling Stone, we did so many interviews. And I would say, you know, he knows that this movie is only 90 minutes. It's only a ice tipberg. You know, what do you call it, the tip of the iceberg? There's so many things he got away with. There's so many things we couldn't mention in here. How dare him come after me? Because I would tell everyone everything, okay? And I have proof for it. So
it's in his best interest to be quiet. And also, we always thought the narcissist in him would run, because narcissists and sociopaths never want to get caught. They just want to do anything
they call
they
can do the narcissistic wound. The narcissistic wound once they're caught. Yeah. So now you in the film, if I remember right, Will, you did confront him on the beach in Hawaii. Was that after the film came out? Before the film came out?
No. That was a really confusing moment. That was like 9 months. For a year before I finished the film. It was like a year before it came out.
Okay.
And I was still undercover. I was still hiding the fact that I was someone he should fear and somebody he should deal with.
Because he wasn't hostile. He seemed like he was a little cautious and cunning, but he wasn't hostile in that exchange.
And I was the same, because I couldn't. I didn't want them to come after me. So that was hard. And I remember that whole shoot was like, okay, well, that was – I went into this situation where I confronted him with a hidden camera, and I was – I felt like it didn't go well. I wanted to get out of there as soon as I could. And so I kept thinking to myself, no one's ever going to see this footage. Let's just get out of here. Save yourself. You know, get out of here. And I'll go back and do it again, you know. And we all said, you're not going to go back and do that again. This is what happened. This is it. This is how you felt. This is how horrible it was to be in front of him. And
now,
I got the
impression in the film also, Chris and Will, that those of you that were victims of the sexual predator abuse, that he made you all think that you were the only one he was physical with, and that it seemed like the comparing of notes that it seemed like there was a pretty high number of guys that might have been a half dozen, a dozen, right? And then you'll find out that he's doing this on a large scale with many of the men in the group, right? I mean, that seemed like it was a bit of a lead domino in the house of cards falling apart.
Yeah, I mean, that didn't come out till the end of our whole experience. I mean, we didn't know what was happening with the left hand and the right hand. I mean, I knew what I knew. Chris knew what he knew. Chris kind of caught on early that, hey, if he's doing this to me, he must be doing it to someone else. I didn't think so. I thought, like, he's just doing this to me. And then later I knew that there was probably one other person who he was doing it with, you know what I mean? But it was one of those things of like, if you can't prove it, I mean, he would lie to my face. I would say something to him like, this is happening. He's like, he'd look at me in the eye and say, that is not happening. That is your story. You know, nothing. And I walk away and I said, he just lied to me there. You know, but I would have to be that bold to say he just lied to me, to myself, because otherwise you have no proof. You have no proof.
Yeah, I mean, a relationship with him, sexual or even not sexual, is just like a life of gaslighting.
Yeah. Gaslighting is the best word for it.
Wow, that is a perfect word. You mentioned now that he's in Hawaii. How old would he be now? Maybe in his 60s? Because you guys were the younger guys, 19, early 20s, and he was probably at that time maybe 40. I don't know. I'm just kind of speculating based on the fact he was in Rosemary's Baby in the 60s.
Yeah. I was 22 when I got in the group, and I figured after seeing what I thought was his real driver's license at one point, that he was like exactly 22 years older than me. I could be wrong, but we've seen his birth certificate if it hasn't been smudged. But so if I was 22, he was 44, which is twice my age.
Uh-huh.
So he's probably 76 right now, is my guess.
76?
I sent you, Richard, I sent you those photographs that he is online in Hawaii on a gay dating site.
Yeah, that blew my mind. For those of you listening, just this morning, and I'd never seen this till right before airtime, Will sent me photos. This guy, after all the being exposed as a sex predator, Will sent me these photos of him on trolling on these sex sites, photoshopped on a gay sex app to lure in new boys.
With a body of a 40-year-old, you know, and a face that he put on somebody else's face. I mean, he's having his disciples or his followers do this for him, do this artwork. I don't know what he's telling them, but he's out there, and he's luring people in, falsely, of course. And, you know, there's something else that some of my friends who live on the island who see him every once in a while after the movie came out, he decided to embrace it. He decided to be proud that I am that man in that film. The first half of the film is truthful. The second half, of course, is not. You know, so part of him, I think what happened was, Richard, because you asked if he's still there, what the backlash was, they didn't run. I mean, the people who are with him now said, you know, if you run again, we're not going to go because we have our lives here now. So he was forced to stay and face the music amongst his people and amongst the society around him, which is as much as you can do. You can tar and feather somebody and let them do the best they can with that. And he's, like I said, he's online secretly.
It's amazing.
You know,
at 76, he's still out there as a predator. I mean, a lot of sexual predators, you know, slow down because of age or something. But it's and after being exposed the way he is, I mean, it's just I'm just stunned that he's still trolling these sites like this.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting things about the exposure too, you referred to our current political climate. The yoga community now out on Oahu has a similar partisan divide going on apparently.
Oh, really?
Half of them that are really in support of what is the recruiting mechanism for this guy through the yoga school and through the organic farming community that they have out there. And then there's the other people that, you know, have seen the film and thought, wow, this guy is a sexual predator and a creep. So it's kind of mirroring what we, you know, what we see in politics right now. It's interesting.
So some of the yoga community in Hawaii is he's a creep, he's a narcissist, he's a predator, but others are tolerant of him recruiting in the yoga community in Hawaii?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I think that because I don't think tolerant is the right word. I think they probably can't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the divide is more 70-30 if there's a divide. Like everybody seems to have his next. But a lot of them know some of the people. Like Chris and I are good people, right? I would guess that some of the people around him are quite good people in this situation, right? And so these people have become friends with other people in the community, and they're not going to – the people who are not in the group are not necessarily willing to believe everything and to continue a friendship with them, which is fine, and kind of ignore the rest. And because they say nothing's happening, they say I'm not with him anymore. They say this stuff because he tells them to, and no one knows what to believe. So they go, well, okay. So yes, it has changed their yoga recruiting techniques, but they're still coming up with new ones and new ways of doing it.
When you say 70-30, Will, am I guessing 70% against and 30% for, or
yeah,
vice versa?
Yeah. No, that's right. 70% of people have his number, they know, and there's a few people who are still with him. And
any guess how many still follow
him
in Hawaii? And does he still have a religious group of sorts where he teaches them and they do these things?
Yep.
Any guess how many are with him now?
I can't guess that. Although I've had friends of mine who said, oh my God, I saw him with a group of 100 people walking on a hike. You know, we were so freaked out. And I'm like, wow, 100 people. Are you sure? So everyone's just guessing. I don't think anyone really knows right now, but they pop up every once in a while in public in a faraway place. He hangs around with a few people where nobody noticed him. He was driving around in a big Mercedes van that had a bed and a kitchen in it, and some woman was driving. So things have changed. A lot of people who were close to him, he treated them very, very badly when the movie came out. Like a lot of his close people who were friends of mine in Austin, when they would question him, he would treat them really badly, and they laughed. They're like, you are not my teacher. You look how you're behaving. You know, you get to see when you take the mask off of the monkey, you see this angry, selfish person underneath it who only cares about himself. And a lot of people never get to see it.
Classic narcissist, huh?
Yeah, and they don't get to see it until they see it. And when they see it, thank God, you know? Yeah.
You mentioned the Mercedes van, and, you know, it seems like there's luxury and resources. I mean, how does he support himself? Is it the followers give him money or give him resources?
Yeah. Yes, we were seeing him for hypnotherapy. In our day and age, we were seeing him for $50 a session. Chris talks about that in the film.
Yeah.
But now it's $100. He's changed the name. When I first met him, it was called therapy. Then in Texas, it was called cleansing, so he couldn't get in trouble for it being called therapy. So he wouldn't have to play by therapy rules, which are out there for a reason. Now he calls it, I've heard from others, that he calls it healing, like a healing. You're going to have a healing for this money. It's $100 a pop, and you go and see him for a hypnosis session and healing. And so we figured out how much he'd made, even if in 5 years, he was there 10 years, even in 5 years, he's probably made hundreds of thousands of dollars. So the house that he was living in we found through research is in four of his disciples' names, who are all yoga teachers and body workers, like masseurs, who can never afford a multi-million dollar house in Hawaii. But the house is in their name in an Alaskan account, and they have an empty warehouse P.O. box in Hawaii. So the whole thing is money laundering, really, if I may be so bold to guess. And people, he has them put their life on the line for him, so nothing can be traced back to him. But they're not making that kind of money. He's making that kind of money.
Mm. You mentioned the $100 therapy/cleansing/healing sessions, and I think you in the film, Chris, said that this turned into him sexually abusing you, and I think, forgive me if I'm remembering wrong, but I think you made the comment, Chris, here I am paying this guy to basically sexually abuse me. When that hits you, you're like, holy hell, you know?
Holy hell.
Am I remembering right that he actually used these sessions to also abuse you?
Well, and that's one of the ways that he makes his move. So, you know, he's grooming you along the way. But it's in these private sessions where everybody that I know of, at least, that had a sexual relationship with him, it started in the therapy session.
Mm-hmm.
And see, that was really something I found out later when I made the movie, because again, none of us were talking. Remember, we weren't really talking to each other about our private things because we were just holding them close to our chest and trying to heal. So when I found out that all this stuff was happening in therapy, that's not how it happened to me. Mine was never in the therapy session. I was traveling with him. I was like his caretaker, his chauffeur, and he slowly took over. But all these other boys were happening in private sessions, which nobody could tell was happening.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was different with the people that lived with him, because you and some of the other people that lived with him, he had access to you 24/7,
yeah.
Whereas the rest
right.
of us, we had a schedule that, albeit daily, right. Wasn't quite involved.
Chris was in a private therapy session of this level for almost 5 years every week. And my, I wouldn't say relationship because there's nothing about it that was a relationship. My encounters with him were about for 5 years weekly. And then I heard from people who were doing it twice a week. He was making them do it. And I was like, geez, wow. And almost every day, once we put all the numbers together, we're like, he has a revolving door.
Do you think he stumbled into this?
He had a morning afternoon.
Oh, go ahead, Chris.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to tag on to that. In Austin, he had a double shift going on. He had a morning and an afternoon.
Oh,
wow.
My God.
I got the feeling from the film that he was failed in these other pursuits, like acting and dancing and these artistic things, and that he kind of – this was almost like the B – plan or the B thing because he didn't make it. He didn't maybe he didn't have enough talent to make it, and this religion thing happened. I mean, that's the feeling I got from it. I mean, do you think he failed and then fell into this thing of being able to con people with the religious stick, or what's your thoughts on that? It seemed like it was his plan B almost, and it just kind of happened.
What Chris and I were talking, and we found out much later that before we met him, he had told one of the earlier disciples, earlier than we were, that I want to have, before he had a following, he said, I want to have a following. I want to have people follow me. So my mind would say, okay, well, that is the narcissist in him that wanted to come to America to be a star. You know, anyone who wants to be a movie star wants to be loved and adored by millions, dancers, applauded, and bravo, bravo. What's the next thing that's parallel to that is to have people adoring you and being a guru. Again, going back to Osho, he sees Osho with 50,000 followers. I want to have followers. Nowadays, it's everywhere. Everybody literally has followers on Instagram. You know, people become professional teachers and whatnot. Back then, there wasn't the internet, so he was still doing that same thing. Like, how do I find value? How do I make a living, right? Because
mm-hmm.
he had a built-in clientele. 7 days a week he worked. So,
and you hint at a very damaged childhood, which was hard. I got the feeling it was hard to even get much information. It was so sketchy, but it seems like there was a lot of trauma and pain and drama with his background, and he ended up doing gay porn and doing all kind of things and was, I think, abandoned or something. I mean, you got the feeling that this guy was a very damaged soul.
Yes, and what's really funny about that is, like, earlier on, I realized he had done porn when I was around him after 5 years. I stumbled upon something, and it was like I shouldn't have stumbled upon it. I wasn't supposed to see it. I saw it, and it was a secret I kept with myself forever. But when I talked to him on some level about his past, he would say, well, Jesus hung out with the prostitutes. Jesus, you know, before someone's a saint, they're a sinner. And I'd be like, okay, you're right. I'm not here to damn you. I'm not here to judge you. I'm not here to say I'm better than you. You're the one, you know. So he would use even that information of him being sexually in a in porn as his past and how he thought, you know, and I bought that. I agreed. I thought, okay, well, that's true. You know, I'm not here to, you know. So it's confusing, especially when you brought spirituality in Jesus. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, he also had a really serious porn addiction. He would have me go to a gay video store on a regular basis and pick up anytime there were new titles on, like, Falcon or there was another one, I forget, but that was one of the many things that he had me do for him. It was definitely an addiction on that level.
And there's a huge part in our DVD. We have 75 minutes of extras if you want to get the DVD. It's quite fascinating, things that didn't make it in the movie, along with his porn addiction and all these things that Chris is talking about. And like I said, it's iTunes has, I think, both. They might have the long edition extras and stuff. But,
on iTunes. Holy hell, by the way, those of you listening, holy hell, it's on iTunes, Amazon, Netflix is the film. You've got to see the film. I know we've whet your appetite for it. One last question coming in here. Janessa Miller in Virginia. She wants to get some final words from each of you on critical thinking. She said that she has followed some cultish people. She was homeschooled and kind of sheltered as a fundamentalist Christian growing up, and she really has problems sometimes with vetting what she hears. And what advice you'd have to just basic critical thinking skills?
Chris, you're great with that one.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, this was the reason that I went back to college after the Buddha field, because I just wanted a methodical way to think. I didn't know how to evaluate information.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, if you're just talking on a brainiac level, the Toulmin model for argumentation is the best, most simple format that you could possibly learn to evaluate the truthfulness of a claim.
Mm-hmm.
But on like the heart and gut level, you know, there were warning signs all along the way. There was bad feelings all along the way, but I was willing to put them aside to stay in the group. And I would say, you know, on that level is trust your gut. Really trust your gut. It's there for you.
Great advice. So you had those yellow lights. Did you also have those kind of yellow lights internally
as well,
Will?
Oh, I very much had those yellow lights. But those yellow lights were the lights we were there to demolish. You know, why are you doubting? Doubting Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
He would make public humiliation out of people if they had any kind of doubt. He would, in front of everybody, he would shame them. Like, one guy was named Doubting Thomas, because you still don't believe me. You still don't believe
me.
You know.
There was one guy he actually nicknamed Doubting Thomas because he was publicly questioning him.
Yeah, not going for it. So, yeah, critical thinking to the girl in Virginia, that's a really big question. And it's like, I think Chris is right. You know, pick up books, start reading, start educating yourself more, because there's a bit of knowledge was withheld from you in that upbringing that you're in. And that's why you feel like you can't maybe have great critical thinking. But there's so much access to information now. There's so much that you can absorb and reject or appreciate and make up your own mind about things.
Yeah, and like you said, Will, that they told you, you know, in the group, don't read other stuff. And she was raised like this, where they didn't let her read stuff outside. So maybe we can leave you, Janessa, with some questions. I have a few, and maybe Will and Chris may also add to these. Critical thinking questions, because I teach our kids to critically think, and our daughter, Karis, is now at Princeton and a scholar, and she told me that kind of the way I raised her helped her a lot. But some of the questions I've taught our kids is, number one, to ask with any claim, what is the evidence for it? And also, what is the source? And is the source a propaganda source? For example, in this politically polarized thing, if you see an extremely right-wing or left-wing claim that, you know, Obama or Hillary is a closet Satanist or Trump's a closet Nazi or whatever, and you see the site is known as a propaganda site for one side, you know, don't put weight in that kind of a site. Oh, also anecdotal evidence, that anecdotal evidence is someone just telling you, I tried this and it worked for me, and so, oh, it must be real, because you can find anecdotal evidence on either side. So Chris and Will got into this group because of relatives or friends or people in the group saying, that, you know, I have so much of a great experience. But just because someone has an anecdote that something is great for them, dig deeper than that, because that's that's the way that you can get sucked into something. I'm just talking off the top of my head. What would you guys, just in closing, have any final words either on that or anything
you
want to leave?
I will add to that really quickly, just because you spurred something in me. Shame on me for this happening to me for so long, you know, but really shame on me if it continues to happen again on any level. And that would just be laziness on my part. It's just laziness to not do what you're talking about, Richard, is to not ask those questions. This is anecdotal. Where's the proof? Where's the, you know, who's saying this? I mean, even if you're getting into a relationship or a job, Tim, here, you have a mind. Don't be lazy. Be aggressive. Be assertive. Take care of yourself. You know, protect yourself. You know, that's how I feel.
You're such wonderful guys to know. You guys are such great guys to know. I'm just so, I don't know, I know, I'm just so proud of you that you had the courage. It is my, you know, I my admiration knows no bounds that you were able to both escape and then have the courage to make this film. And anything else in final words you'd add as well, Chris?
I just wanted to say, look who has the power in a relationship. Who's got the power, who's benefiting from the relationship in real terms and not just feelings.
Excellent. You're both so
and
intelligent,
Richard,
and articulate. You know, you've got your power back. You both got your power back.
Yeah.
Well, it's been
a
journey.
Process. It is a process. I'm looking forward to seeing what I feel like 10 years from now even, you know. And, Richard, thank you so much. Your questions have been great. You're so scholarly in this subject, and you're so fair about it. I really, really appreciate talking to you.
Oh, you're most welcome, Will. Well, I have to ask one last thing, even though we're over time, and they're giving us a lot of grace here to go over time. But let me – I'm just want to see you guys just prosper and be blessed and bloom and you know, have just a great second half of life, because, you know, you had this Rip Van Winkle thing where you were kind of out of the world for 20 years. What are the future plans in terms of your lives? More films, Will, and you, Chris. I think in the postscript of the film it says that you're doing lectures. And Chris, what are you guys doing in the future?
Well, I'm working in film. I'm moving forward with documentaries. I'm working on a documentary about the legendary choreographer of Cats and Phantom of the Opera and her 30-year relationship with a man 30 years younger than her. She's 90, he's 63. It's a really fantastic film. We're starting it next month, and I'm producing that. I'm directing a few things that are documentary-oriented.
Is that Jillian Lynn?
Jillian, yes, it is, yeah. I should send you my stuff. I'll let you see the link. It's quite fun.
I can't wait to
see
it.
I'm really excited about it. Yeah, and then I'm also turning our early years of the Buddha Field into a television show, dramatic series. In the process of that, and that's really exciting.
Excellent.
Then working with fiction films too, trying to get into some fiction stuff, but it's all in the works. And Chris?
Yeah, well, I work in the San Francisco Bay Area as a mediator, and I do recreational facilitation for family members that have become estranged through traumatic events like high conflict divorce or kidnappings, joining cults, things like that. So that's what most of my life is focused on as far as work and that goes. And I'm also writing a book about cults.
Wow. Well, I can't wait to get any and all of your stuff. For those of us that have been through this, any of you listening that have been through this, I think the work that Will and Chris are both doing is kind of a purging to make a film about it. Chris now doing mediation for those damaged by similar things. Some of you know I came out of a cult and wrote a coming-of-age novel, Stickman, which processed my whole experience with that. So anything that you can all do if you've been through this to express yourself creatively or in your work to kind of, you know, in our work we kind of heal ourselves.
And
so
Richard,
can I
add one more thing?
Sure.
I want to say one more thing about that. The reason that's so healing is because it's your ego coming in and your creative ego. The party that got suppressed, the party that got oppressed. So let that part of you out. Let it have a voice. Let it express itself. You know, assert that part of yourself. You know, that's your power. That's my will. My name is Will, right? And he changed my name to Francesco. So when I came out, I put my name back to Will. It was very difficult.
Excellent.
It's a very strong will, and I had to get my willpower back, you know.
Mm.
And that for me was, I was a filmmaker as a child, so that's what that was for me. But
that's
everyone has their own.
That's so poetic and literary that he literally took will away. He wanted to take your will.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you guys are great. Some of the comments coming in, just so you know, one thing that keeps coming through, people sending in comments, is that these guys are great. Great to know these guys. So, I mean, you're just coming across to our listeners as, our listeners are so into your story. How can they keep in touch with either of you or reach either of you and keep up with what you're doing?
We have a Holy Hell page on Facebook.
Oh,
that's one great
okay.
way. I'm on Instagram, Will_Allen. 405, but Facebook is a great place. We get a lot of comments and conversations started on Facebook, and
on the Holy Hell website.
Holy Hell, it's the Holy Hell's Facebook site.
Okay, great. How about you, Chris? The same or anything else you want to add on contact?
Yeah, that's really the best way to get in touch with me. I'm also personally on Facebook, so send me a message if there's any questions.
Yeah.
I'm happy to answer.
Yeah,
and any of you guys that are my friends, a lot of the listeners are my friends. Will and Chris are under my friends also.
Yay.
Well, thank you so much for this wonderful, oh, my God, it just flew by. I can't believe we've been talking for 70 minutes. Yeah. It seems like seven because it's been so interesting. And I just ate up your film, and the extras are great, by the way. Those of you, there's a ton of extra stuff in addition to the film on the DVD that gives you more background on this. Thank you so much for coming on. Will and Chris, you guys are so great, and I just know that your best days are ahead and the best is yet to come for you guys.
Thank you, Richard.
Well, thank you very much, Richard.
And God bless you both. And I want to tell all of you listening, we're kind of on a cult theme here now, because I want to tell you about next show on October 16th, Monday. We have an author coming on that wrote a book, The Girl at the End of the World. Her name's Elizabeth Esther. We had a woman on from Australia named Amy Smith, and many of you listen to that show, who escaped a Pentecostal fundamentalist cult in Australia. The book that inspired her and got her out of that was a book called Girl at the End of the World. And it's this woman, Elizabeth Esther, whose grandfather started one of the biggest and most influential fundamentalist cults called the Assembly. And the thinking of this group was a part and parcel of some of the Christian people that I was around as a young person and was damaged by. And Elizabeth has just blown, like these guys, blown the lid off this cult, written this book, and it's so well written. And I'm so looking forward to having Elizabeth Esther next Monday, same bat time, 11 a.m. PST Pacific time, 2 p.m. Eastern time. Elizabeth Esther will be joining us. That's coming up next Monday, the 16th. You don't want to miss that show. It is going to be really great. Also coming up, many of you saw and commented on my interview on CBS News about families fighting fentanyl. And we'll be doing a show with our group, Families Fighting Fentanyl, and some of the other people that have lost someone to fentanyl, and how we're banding together to fight this horrible opioid epidemic for those of us that lost someone in our family recently to it, including me. So we'll be doing a show about that October 28th. But thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Jesus, God, never were about religion. They were about relationship. They were about healing in the healthy sense of the word. Toxic religion hurts people, and healthy faith heals people. So if you're in any way in some sort of damaging religious group, do what these guys did and get the hell out and lose your religion. Love that song, Losing My Religion. Lose your religion. Lose all those programs, all those things that were put in you by somebody else to control you, and think for yourself. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really appreciate your support of the show. Be blessed, each and every one of you.